Welcome, everyone, to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. I am your co-host, Eric Lindblade, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jim Hessler. Jim, what's our episode tonight?
Thanks, Eric, and welcome back, everybody, as we are playing a home game once again at Getty's Gear. Tonight, we're going to do part one of the wheat field. Now, Eric and Jody, who is also joining us, probably the wheat field might be the most in-demand topic we've had to date, and it's a complex one, so we're going to break it down. Almost any Gettysburg student will tell you that they consider the July 2nd fighting on the Rose Farm in the wheat field to be among the most confusing segments of the Battle of Gettysburg. So over 2 hours of furious attacks and counterattacks, some portions of the wheat field change hands. Well, find out how many times we think that happens. But it's really taken us to the conclusion of 4 seasons of the podcast to finally get to our deep dive on the wheat field. You know, guys, we've had good times, bad times, laughter, some tears.
Hard times.
But we've got no script here. There's a lot to unpack. We're going to take as many parts as it takes, even if all of the upcoming season 5 is needed for the wheat field. So folks, buckle up. This is the wheat field part 1 to start concluding season 4 of the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. And before we kick it over, we're also joined by super fan Jody. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Jim, and everybody out there listening. I'm really excited about recording the wheat field. I started, you know, studying up and realized that I didn't know as much as I thought I did. Mm. And it's very confusing.
Well, it's certainly a request we get a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I know probably if there's a part of the field that I get the most requests for, it's usually wheat field tours or Culp's Hill. But I think in many ways, they're both very confusing actions. And what we're going to try to do is kind of cut through some of that confusion and really look at the wheat field and really kind of the deep dive style that we are known for. And I think it's going to be, I think, very enlightening. I hope by the end, maybe people come away not as intimidated by the wheat field.
Well, you hope not. There's, you know, there's this cliche among almost everybody, all battlefield guides, that almost everybody will say, you know, if you break the wheat field down into phases, it's not as confusing. And frankly, that's true. The question is going to be, how are we going to define the phases? How are we going to define the wheat field? But then what do we determine those phases to be? And like you said, just break it down for people. We're a little bit of cross purposes here because, you know, we want to make it simple so that people will understand the wheat field like they never have before. Yet, we're also going to have to give them the Battle of Gettysburg podcast trademarked deep dives that we are known across the territory for. So it should be interesting to see where this goes.
To your point about what is exactly the wheat field, where do we define the parameters of what is the wheat field? And even the idea of the phases. We can't even agree on how many phases there are in the wheat field. We posted about we're going to be recording this, asked, you know, how many times the wheat field change hands? Yeah. And my response was somewhere between 1 and 100. Pick your number. it's going to be in there somewhere. So I think what we're going to do is there's a lot to look at. And what we're going to kind of do is give you that big picture view here for episode 1, get these forces onto the field, kind of describe what the wheat field is or how we are describing it will be. Plus, look at a little bit of the people that would have lived on that, the Rose family, which saw much of the fighting on their property. So I think it's going to be a lot to cover, and we're certainly looking forward to it. This is by far our most ambitious project yet, really, I think, in terms of scope of a topic.
It is, and I'm feeling pressure to do it right. Not for us, because like you, I do a ton of wheat field tours, especially a lot of times in conjunction with peach orchard tours. I'm not feeling the pressure for us. I'm feeling the pressure on behalf of the listeners, because we know from the social media comments and the messages from fans, they want us to get this right. Everybody has messaged us saying they want us to cover their favorite regiment or their favorite brigade and all of that stuff. So I not pressure, but I feel a responsibility to do this one right. What do you say, Jody?
And I think there's a lot of human interest stories, too. And a lot of mystery because a lot of these men didn't make it out. So we don't know exactly what happened. And a lot of the accounts don't match at times.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to run into. There are still some gaps in primary source material. A good example of that is Paul Sims's brigade.
Yeah.
Trying to find a lot of good detailed accounts from that brigade is very tough. There's a lot of factors that I think make the wheat field intimidating to a lot of folks. And I think
we hope that we can kind of and yeah. makes it more mysterious. And
you don't know how many times I've had people say, I want to do a wheat field tour because I don't understand the wheat field.
Oh, yeah. That's
I don't get it.
Say. And, that's what they always say.
And
yeah.
I think that's a common mm-hmm. request. And this is certainly a topic that people have wanted us to cover even from the very start.
Yeah.
And so we're finally getting to it, but I think we're at a point where we can give it the treatment it deserves. And I think if we can't do it, I don't know who else can.
That's right. You know, last week we crossed Lincoln at Gettysburg off of the bucket list, and now we're in the wheat field. So, all right, should we get going here?
Yeah, let's begin at the start, maybe by that basic question. What are we defining as the wheat field?
So if I could throw out with a disclaimer, because I think one of the problems hardcore Gettysburg enthusiasts tend to do is overthink things. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the wheat field? Well, it's a field full of wheat kind of thing. And, you know, not overthink it.
Yes, you are correct. It's a field of wheat.
Yeah. Basic there.
Yeah. Well, but seriously, you know, I'm a sane man in an increasingly insane world. And, you know, what would any sane person consider to be the wheat field at Gettysburg? You've got 20 plus acres of golden ripe wheat on the George Rose farm.
A week away from being harvested.
That's right. That's right.
What a travesty.
I'm sure it just looked beautiful.
That tempts the tiller's blade.
That we're going to call the wheat field. All right, Jody, you want to keep count? So okay. the wheat, we've got the wheat field
right.
as the wheat field. That's one. Rose's Woods and the fighting beyond Rose's Woods, stretching to the Rose House, the barn, and really all the way to the Emmitsburg Road and that south end of Peach Orchard. Would we agree?
I often, on a wheat field tour, describe the wheat field as using, if we kind of picture you're standing in the middle of the wheat field. Imagine you're looking to the north towards the Wheatfield Road. I kind of consider the Wheatfield Road as sort of the northern boundary.
It absolutely
of
is.
Its, yeah. I think if we then look at what would be the quote-unquote eastern boundary, we're maybe looking at kind of that part of Houck's Ridge you get over to as you're looking, going through Ayers Avenue today, looking towards Little Round Top. But we could also include, at a certain level, the Valley of Death
well,
into the Wheatfield well, as
well. So I had that on my list. So before we forget... Yeah, we'll put Rose's Woods and the Rose Farm to the west. Eric has covered the boundaries to the east, and I want to come back to the Valley of Death, but I just don't want to forget Stony Hill. Stony Hill, we're obviously going to include that as part of the wheat field. And then, yeah, let's go back to your comment, Eric, about then to the east, do we count the Valley of Death? And here's how I always look at this. Look. Terrain-wise, topographically, it's not part of the wheat field, but obviously it plays a part with troops going back and forth and does play an element into the fighting on that part. So I usually include it as the fighting. I do.
And we get into those weird areas for a unit such as, say, the 3rd Arkansas. Are they part of the fighting in Devil's Den? Or are they part of the fighting in the wheat field? Are they in this sort of weird area where they are part of both?
Well, that gets back into the overthinking that
right.
thing, right? Right? The third...
So are we thinking the original 3rd Corps line and the area that's around it that's getting attacked?
Yeah. I mean, so the stone wall in right. front of Rose's Woods,
right.
which initially, as we'll talk about, a lot of which was originally occupied by 3rd Corps, that's definitely part of it.
Right.
But I would include that in kind of the Rose's Woods area. You know, the whole 3rd Arkansas and what's mm-hmm. Devil's Den. Yeah. I mean, the 17th Maine... is shooting at the 3rd Arkansas. I usually include the 20th Indiana. Mm-hmm. Now, I know some people include the 99th Pennsylvania. I, folks, do not include the 99th Pennsylvania.
That's where you're drawing the line.
That's okay. Right, Jody. All right? Mark that down. We've drawn
the 99th
a line.
Pennsylvania.
Well,
I
think
we're drawing it.
I put them in Devil's Den.
Maybe okay. a certain level, if you were either shooting out of the wheat field area at something or shooting into the wheat field area... Yeah. That's part of it. Yeah. And I think even if you would look to the west, Kershaw's brigade, certainly involved on Stony Hill.
Oh, definitely. Hill,
but
yeah.
I would also say they're part of the fighting at the Peach Orchard.
Oh, they are, yeah.
So I think it is it's very hard, I think, at times to define. There's not lines that were drawn saying, okay, you've gone over this, you're now into the Peach Orchard.
Well, for me personally, a lot of tours I do, people ask me to do the wheat field and the Peach Orchard together. And really, everything in and around the Rose Farm, with the artillery from the Wheatfield Road, from the Southern Peach Orchard, that's all one action to me. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole what is the Wheatfield, what is the Peach Orchard, by definition is an artificial sort of designation. But I think personally, for our intents and purposes, yeah, there's no doubt we're going to include Kershaw in the Stony Hill fight. I'm going back to your 3rd Arkansas Devil's Den question. And again, I'm drawing the line, 3rd Arkansas, yes, but really nobody to their right. And frankly, on the Union side, I would kind of count the 20th Indiana as kind of our left boundary.
If we're going to create kind of an artificial boundary, maybe as you're driving through Devil's Den, when you enter the woods, you're entering Rose's Woods.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe that is that just kind of artificial. But we have to remember, we are creating these artificial boundaries. The soldiers were just fighting over this area. They weren't thinking of this is part of this action or that. These are all post-war interpretations that are defining these kind of arbitrary lines.
I mean, you're right. And somebody's going to comment and say, that is the quote of the year. And my response would be, no shit, Sherlock. You know, nobody comes in and says, I'm fighting in the wheat field today. This is Jim, Eric, and Jody trying to define what are we going to cover is the wheat field on the Battle of Gettysburg podcast.
And I think we have to put parameters in, because otherwise this thing's going to, basically we're just going to cover the entire southern end of the field. If we're not careful, because as you pointed out, it's all interconnected. And in many ways, all the pieces matter. So what we're going to do in this is, I think, start to introduce the opening phases of this, kind of what is the wheat field, who's going to be there initially, and we're going to kind of, I think our goal today is to end it really right before the shooting starts.
Yeah.
And then we'll get into the fighting all the way, and we've actually discussed maybe going all the way into July 3rd and 4th in the wheat field. People are going, wait a minute, July 3rd and 4th? That's not the wheat field.
That's outrageous.
You mean there's fighting elsewhere on July 3rd other than Pickett's Charge and Culp's Hill and East Cavalry Field? Yes, there is, folks. But what I think we'll look at is kind of try to give as comprehensive a view of the wheat field as possible and maybe touch on some topics that people don't really look at, if ever, especially the fighting on July 3rd, July 4th in that area.
Or 6 parts from now, we could be so thoroughly physically and mentally exhausted from talking about this. Maybe we'll just wrap it up. Who knows, folks? That's why you got to stick with us.
Yeah, by the end of it, we're like George Anderson's brigade. Exactly. We've been in this thing from the start. Let's just get out of here. I'm tired of the wheat field.
Anderson, George Anderson, folks.
George Anderson.
Not Dick Anderson.
No, no, not Richard Dick Anderson. No, it is George Anderson, for those keeping score at home. All right, well, with all that said, let's start to kind of get into it. So I think the first area we should maybe start is who lived on this property. I think that's the best place to start.
That's a great point. Great place to start. Who lived here? And Jody, you in your introduction had kind of talked about the human interest and the civilians and that sort of thing. So the area that we're going to call the wheat field, really the Rose Farm, it's really the fight for the Rose Farm, was purchased by George and Dorothy Rose in 1858. Now, George was a butcher from the Philadelphia area, so George Rose did not live on the Rose Farm. I should point out, when he bought the property in 58, the farmhouse was already there and seemed to have dated back to around 1811 or so, I think, with some subsequent additions into 1824. And the barn was supposedly built around 1812. Now, George, as I said, bought the property for $8,000. You guys know in 2023 what $8,000 in 1858 dollars would be worth today? I did that calculation just for the Battle of Gettysburg podcast.
What did the inflation calculator say?
Drum roll, Jody.
Okay, I'm
ready. Are you on the edge of your seat?
Yeah, can't wait.
So $8,000 in 1858 would be equivalent to about $300,166 today.
That's not bad.
So, well, you know, I was thinking about that. Clearly, George Rose had some bucks. You know, again, he's a butcher in Philly. He's got a lot of stuff going on. So you could say, well, you know, I could get a nice battlefield piece of stone house for $300,000, but the farm itself was over 200 acres.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a steal.
So that's actually a pretty good deal. I mean, I don't think anybody's getting over 200 acres and a house today in Adams County actually, for that amount of money.
Exactly.
I'm glad you bring that up, because that's a large farm back then.
Yeah, yeah. Allegedly, supposedly at that time, it was about 230 acres. Hmm. Now, Jody, you're a farmer. Yeah. You own a lot of property, right?
Right. That's a large farm.
If somebody offered you 230 acres for $300,000, what would you do?
Well, I would, no.
No.
No. It's worth a lot more now.
Well, are they throwing goats into this?
Yeah, fainting
is it
goats.
Like 300,000 plus like goats and a cow to be named later, or right. You know, in cash considerations? How are we doing this?
But don't forget the golden ripe wheat.
Even though he didn't live there, it was being farmed, right? He had tenant farmers in the house.
Well, he did. So his brother John's wife Anne, and their 7 children primarily lived on the property. But to your point, in addition to John Rose and his family, they also had tenant farmers. And probably the most noteworthy one as it relates to the Battle of Gettysburg, because he seems to have been there at the time of the Battle of Gettysburg, was Francis Ogden. And there's some deal where Ogden and John Rose, I think they each have sort of a share or a portion of the wheat field and stuff like that. I don't think it's really clear if Ogden was living in the Rose property at the time. You'll see some sources that say, yes, he was there also. You'll see other sources that aren't as sure on it.
Wait, conflicting sources relating to the wheat field?
Exactly.
What?
Right.
My gosh, we can't even get these people living on this property before we get conflicting sources.
You mean the tenant farmer didn't look ahead and say, some podcast is going to be talking about me 160 years from now?
I need to write my memoirs right now.
So yeah, anyway, so John and George seem to have sort of worked out a deal where they split the interest on the crops in exchange for John and the family to live on the property, maintain the residence, work the house. And then again, as we've said, because it was so large, you got to have these other guys working with you too. So this is a going concern. You know, there's a lot to unpack here with the Roses.
And keep in mind, when this fighting is going to take place on July 2nd, much of what would have been the summer harvest is getting ready to be brought in. Mm-hmm. So what we have is on the eve of battle, really this kind of thriving, prosperous farm. I mean, if you tour the property today, it would have everything you would want for a farm in the 19th century. You have a beautiful house, you have a barn, you have rolling pasture land, you have a 22-acre field of wheat, roughly. A lot of things you would want, and in a matter of hours, it'll be absolutely devastated.
Yeah, that's right. And not only is it devastated and the crops are devastated, but when we talk about all the personal property in the house that was primarily destroyed by these two armies, that's primarily John Rose's, you know, and everything that they had was lost and cleaned out, obviously, as well. The story seems to be that with the upcoming approach of the armies, Ogden had a little bit of foresight and got out and took some of his animals and his property and some of that stuff. But John Rose might have waited a little too long to get out of Dodge. And so, again, I think most of the damage was to personal property on the Rose farm was due to John's stuff.
Maybe the better name for this should be the Fighting for the Rose Farm. If you look at it as far as the farm in its totality, that makes a lot more sense than just a 22-acre field of wheat, roughly.
And I personally agree with all of that. So, Jody, let's stop the recorder, rewind. This is now the Fight for the Rose Farm.
Yes, the Fight for the Rose Farm. We're changing it in the middle of the show.
Do you think other people will start to follow us, you know?
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time people have copied us.
Every book that comes out now will be the Fight for the Rose Farm and not the wheat field.
And the best part is everyone will claim they were the first to call it that.
Yes, absolutely. So,
but I think it's a good kind of parameter. And I think it's important when we think of the battle here to think of the folks that did live on these farms. That, you know, we think of it as battlefield today, but on June 30th, 1863, it's just farmland in Adams County.
Yeah, and I should have mentioned, and I'm sure I probably did mention it in the Peach Orchard episode, but prior to the Rose family living on the Rose farm, one of the local residents who was born on the Rose property was Joseph Sherfy.
Hey, the good reverend.
Exactly. So again, we talk about our artificial boundaries, you know, not really being boundaries, but Sherfy, born on what we call today as the Rose Farm at the Battle of Gettysburg, is just living up the hill, you know, at the Sherfy Farm. So,
yeah, points out that's where I was born all those years ago. And it also shows that in a lot of cases, I mean, think about it, Sherfy's born on what will become the Rose Farm.
Right.
He just moves up the road. It's a good example of a lot of folks in the 19th century don't always travel that far, you know.
And also, like, if you look at it back then, if you had a fire or personal, like, devastation, you could count on your neighbors. Well, after the battle, they're all devastated.
There's no way to the devastation of the Sherfy farm is probably just as bad as the devastation of the Rose farm. Go across the Wheatfield Road to the Trossels, it's just as bad. That whole neighborhood is devastating.
And you know, the distinct disadvantage, of course, that the Roses will have, in addition to the property damage, will be the massive numbers of dead buried on their property, which we'll talk about more in the aftermath.
So now that we've introduced who lives on the property, have given a sense of what we will consider the, whether it's the wheat field fighting or the Rose farm fighting, whichever term you'd like to use is now applicable. But let's now sort of pivot to the military activity that's going to take place there. And Jim, the first military activity that we'll see on the Rose Farm actually is not on July 2nd. It's on July 1st. and whose troops might actually be occupying that property on the evening of July 1st.
Well, could this be a preliminary installment of the Dan Sickles report before we get to the actual Dan Sickles report?
So we're going to have like multiple Dan Sickles reports?
To go along with the multi-part fighting on the Rose Farm?
I think
that's called for.
Is there ever too much Dan Sickles reports? I mean, I think people would be upset if we didn't have enough. So I think we have to make sure that we get as many in as we can.
First of all, we were negligent when we were defining the boundaries of the wheat field. We were negligent in not mentioning that the modern day lengthy Sickles Avenue runs right through the wheat field.
Yes, it does. One of the longest avenues on the park as well.
Jody, do you want to count that as Sickles reference number one? So Jody in our Getty's gear locker room here today is going up to the whiteboard and doing the X's and the O's for the Rose Farm here.
I think Sickles would be proud at your lengthy comment.
I think he would be proud.
So when we will see the first troops, and obviously what you would see in the week before the battles, you have Union and Confederate soldiers passing through. Union cavalry goes up the Emmitsburg Road in the days before. So certainly, those living in that area would be seeing troops passing through time and time. But the most troops they will begin to see is starting on July 1st on that property. And of course, we know these will be troops under the command of your hero and mine, Dan Sickles.
Yes, as we take a second stab at answering the question. So you're right, Eric. So, and again, as Eric mentioned in the comment there, obviously during the approach of the Army of the Potomac on July 1st, portions of the First Corps, portions of the 11th Corps, and finally portions of the 3rd Corps marching up the Emmitsburg Road, first of all, would have passed by the Rose and the Scherfe property. And, somebody's going to ding us for forgetting to mention Buford passing that on the 30th. So
listen to our June 30th
episode. That's right.
How about that?
Yeah. Some good cross promotion there. So, on the 1st, with the 3rd Corps starting to arrive at Gettysburg, late afternoon, early evening is kind of where we'll time frame that. Obviously, as they're coming up the Emmitsburg Road and eventually moving across into Bivouac, in and around Cemetery Ridge, but you have skirmishers and elements of the 3rd Corps put out on the Emmitsburg Road that night. And you really could probably, artificial boundaries, whether any of them are stepping foot on the Rose property or the Scherfe Wentz property, clearly, folks, they are in the vicinity. And you could, as Eric has kind of asked here, you could sort of position that as the first real occupation of the Rose neighborhood. We'll call it the neighborhood.
And I think as we then move into even early morning July 2nd, there's troops in the area. But it doesn't factor into George Meade's battle line. It doesn't really factor into Confederate planning at this moment, which I think is kind of an interesting aspect of if you would look at where you think the fighting's going to take place. I don't think the Rose Farm would have registered on the morning of July 2nd.
It's
going to be the scene of some of the most intense fighting of this battle, interestingly enough. And what we will see is by the 2nd, you have troops moving through that area. As you said, you have skirmishers out along the Emmitsburg Road. You have a lot of activity going on, but it does not appear that there's going to be fighting on this property, which if you're there, you maybe hope, breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. But as I say, it's going to change very soon.
Yeah, and you're right. And obviously the Wheatfield Road is starting to get more traffic through the morning of the 2nd. And that skirmishing that we've talked about does pick up. More 3rd Corps troops, again, get pushed onto the Emmitsburg Road skirmish line. Now, I have seen some modern historians, I'm not going to mention names because, I don't do that, but I have seen some modern historians kind of pivot a skirmish line in the morning of July 2nd, working all the way from the Emmitsburg Road Peach Orchard south in front of the Rose property down into in front of the Round Tops itself. Now, we know there's some U.S. sharpshooters in and around the Slider property. There's some not really clearly documented movements of a couple regiments in Ward's brigade kind of going in and out. So yes, clearly movement across the property from the 3rd Corps and Buford's cavalry. Because remember, folks, where is Buford on the morning of the 2nd, some of his guys are bivouacked in and around the peach orchard with, you know, at least some level of patrols going up and down the Emmitsburg Road and the Millerstown Road. So you're right. As the morning starts to pick up, we haven't advanced Sickles forward yet, but there's clearly at least more and more army activity in and around the Rose property itself.
We should even add, by the morning of July 2nd, George Meade is not really looking towards that part of the field. His attention is more turned towards the kind of the Culp's Hill, Cemetery Hill corridor along the Baltimore Pike, where he believes that Confederate attack is going to be made, not in that area to the south. So I think what we really see by the morning of July 2nd is one Army commander, George Meade, is looking to the north and to the east. Another Army commander, Robert E. Lee, is looking to the south, which will ultimately start to put the bullseye on this property.
Yeah, it has. And geez, I can't even remember. Have we done a Johnston's reconnaissance episode yet? I don't
remember.
We haven't done that. Did we do a countermarch one?
Yes, we did.
Did we do?
Yes,
all
we
right,
have
great.
Done the countermarch. You were there.
I was there.
Yeah,
right.
You were there for it.
Rumor has it I was probably talking too, right? So all kidding aside, my point kind of being, is Lee, meanwhile, is starting to figure out what is his army going to do on the second day. Starts sending more and more reconnaissance parties to the south. Pendleton, of course, Johnston's is the most famous one.
We're saying that Lee was going to attack there or thinking about it before Sickles ever moved?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Shocking.
Irony alert, huh?
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so from that perspective, Lee is starting to send recon parties out that way. Again, part of the mystery with the Johnston recon is sort of how he bypasses pickets and Union patrols. That's a conversation for a different time. But yeah, Meade is really thinking in and around the town, as many people know, Slocum and Warren kind of talk Meade out of looking at offensive operations along his right, Cemetery Hill, Culp's Hill, while Lee is doing the recon. And eventually, long story short, Lee will decide to launch the attack against the Union left.
And that makes a lot of sense for the Confederate Army. Obviously, the area south of Gettysburg gives Lee the ability to better utilize his artillery along Seminary Ridge extending to the south. Of course, the ridges that define the Gettysburg battlefield gives Lee the ability to move large numbers of soldiers, theoretically out of the eyes of his opponent. And also, that area south of Gettysburg is much more open. He can maneuver his troops on the field. And of course, having the ability to not only utilize your artillery, move troops undetected, and also be able to maneuver them once they're going into an attack, really, in Lee's mind, that's the only place to attack on July 2nd, at least your main attack. And that's what he will be focusing on throughout the morning into the early afternoon of July 2nd.
Yeah, and there still remains a lot of mystery and confusion around what are Lee's objectives on July 2nd. And you see a lot of people interpreting this differently. Thanks to the morning recons, which again, folks, we're not doing in detail here today, Lee clearly thinks the Union left ends short of the Round Tops, and you could argue short of the Wheatfield Road intersection. Because of that, what I think Lee is trying to do is twofold, telling Longstreet he's going to send Longstreet around to basically partially envelop the Union left, wherever that may be, partially envelop the Union left and drive it in, and also to gain the Emmitsburg Road from which to use his artillery to support the ongoing attacks on Cemetery Ridge. That's kind of the two-pronged attack that I think Lee is doing here on the south end of the battlefield. Both of those will have deadly implications for the Rose property.
And we don't do what-if history because, well, we don't know what would have happened. But if we would look at what Lee's quote-unquote original plan was on July 2nd, you would have certainly had a large portion of Confederate forces moving through the Rose property as they would have been moving towards that Union flank wherever they would discover it. So even if Sickles doesn't move forward, the Rose Farm is going to see some level of devastation as thousands of troops are poised to be moving over it. Now, it's much better to have a division moving over your property than having divisions fight on your property. But either way, this property is going to become a part of this battle one way or the other.
Yeah, once the Union left extends anywhere in that vicinity, whether it be Little Round Top, whether it be Cemetery Ridge or the Emmitsburg Road, the Union left in that vicinity is Lee's objective. And I'm kind of hammering this home because I keep running into people who say Lee's objective is to attack up the Emmitsburg Road. Mm-hmm. That is not the main objective. The main objective is the left of the Union Army. Now, when Sickles moves forward, the positioning of Sickles' army, Emmitsburg Road, Peach Orchard, Devil's Den, with troops on the Rose property and the wheat field, is ultimately what's going to lead to the fighting there. But ultimately, wherever that Union left in is going to be Lee's objective and ultimately Longstreet's to try to drive in.
And certainly the Emmitsburg Road would make a natural guide, and I'm using kind of air quotes here for that. If you're making an attack in that vicinity, it's a natural guide for your flanks, but they're not wedded to the Emmitsburg Road.
Right.
I think that's where people have gotten it kind of confused, is that just because they could very well use it, depending on where that flank is, doesn't mean that Lee says attack up the Emmitsburg Road. But it would be a natural guide if you would be.
If the Union left facilitates that.
Correct.
The thing that Lee says that nobody ever talks about is Lee uses the word gain. Gain for artillery, not just blindly attack up it. And why are we throwing this out? Because if Sickles doesn't move forward and Sickles stays back to where Meade wants him to be, you know, I encounter many people who think Longstreet is just going to blindly march up the Emmitsburg Road and allow a Sickles who is back on Cemetery Ridge to just sort of rake his Longstreet's flank in his rear. And he's not going to do that. Longstreet is not going to blindly attack up the Emmitsburg Road. And you don't need a what if to prove that. That's what happens when they get into position. Jimmies are getting rustled, Jody.
I know. I'm seeing you.
When the Confederates get into position and they realize the Union left is not where they thought it was going to be, that totally changes the positioning of the attack. McLaws goes in opposite the Peach Orchard, but Hood's division is going to work around further to the Confederate right, and I'm going to use the phrase again, to partially envelop the Union left and drive it in. As part of Hood's division, those are some of the guys, G.T. Anderson's brigade in particular, who is going to kick off the Confederate phase of the fighting in the wheat field.
Anderson's brigade, they're sort of the one constant in the wheat field. As we're going to be seeing throughout these episodes, they are in the thick of it
almost
the entire time. And what we often think of when we think of Hood's division, obviously the brigades that really get the most attention, first and foremost, of course, is the Texas Brigade. I would argue second is probably Evander Law's brigade. You get some people that are really into Binning, but Anderson kind of gets forgotten. But thankfully, you know, as we're going to be focusing on, I think, a brigade that doesn't always get the attention on July 2nd that maybe it deserves.
That's exactly right. And one of you said at the beginning about Semmes as well. And so you think about it, the typical visitor, student to Gettysburg, never talks about G.T. Anderson's brigade, never talks about Semmes's brigade. And, you know, when we get onto the Union side of the wheat field, how often does the typical person talk about Burling's brigade? Maybe a little bit of Detroit-Brienne, but there's a lot of guys here that normally just don't get any coverage. And you're right, I would put G.T. Anderson at the top of that list. Semmes is a close second.
I think this is where the Confederate accounts just aren't what we would really want. I mean, there's parts of this field where you have a lot of primary source material that really gives you a good sense of what is happening in the Confederate Army. You do not really get that always in the wheat field, which are significant gaps that really, I think, add to that confusion. I don't think the confusion is as much what happens there as much as it is the sources we do not have about what happens there, because we're missing big gaps. Imagine trying to put together a puzzle and you only have 3/4 of the pieces. You can get a sense of the picture, but there's still going to be things that you're not really sure about.
Well, you're a Southerner.
Well, I am a Southerner.
As he wears his Cleveland Indians, I'm sorry, Guardians hat.
It's actually a Cleveland Spiders hat.
Oh, is that what that
is?
Yes,
the team before the Indians.
Oh, okay. So, well, yeah. So, you know, in general, do you ever notice Georgians just don't write a lot? We mentioned Semmes before, right?
Yeah.
And you see this with Wofford and other guys, and even Gordon's brigade, you know, on the first day's field. How about we do this? So we're doing this without a script, without a safety net. We've kind of started to focus on Confederate movements first. We haven't even gotten Sickles' guys into the wheat field yet. But since we're here and we're talking about it, so we don't have to come back to it later, should we meet G.T. Anderson?
Yeah, let's meet George Anderson. I think this is a good time to introduce him.
George Thomas Anderson, born February 3rd, 1824, which would make him 39 years old at the Battle of Gettysburg.
Aww. Yeah. He's a February baby.
Just like Superfan Jody.
That's right.
Yeah. And all the other February Superfan babies that are out there.
Yeah, it's a big month for them.
Are you a February baby?
No, I'm March.
The broken TV in Chambersburg Street was February?
No, that was in March.
Oh, I don't remember.
You were there.
I know I was. That was like 20 years ago.
It was almost 20 years.
All right. So anyways, G.T. Anderson. Now, the T for Thomas, of course, he is more famously nicknamed Tig. I always pronounce it as Tig because it's short for Tiger. Now, Anderson was described by at least one historian as a striking, well-defined face with dark, wavy hair and a full but neatly trimmed beard. Now, maybe when we put this up on YouTube, I'll put up a photo of Anderson. In the meantime, folks, imagine a white guy with facial hair. Okay.
That narrows it down on this battlefield.
Considerably. All right. So Anderson was born in Covington, Georgia. I got to admit, I've never been to Covington, Georgia. He attended Emory University and did see service during the Mexican War. So from 1848 until 1850, he was also Major General of a division of Georgia Militia. He received a commission as a captain in the 1st U.S. Cavalry in 1855 before resigning a couple years later.
So he's
later.
A seasoned soldier.
Exactly. So he's right. Got some experience, Mexico and all that stuff before the Civil War, which will come into play when they're raising troops at the beginning of the, I'm making air quotes, the rebellion.
And I think what we see is this brigade, while it maybe does not garner the attention of others in the division, I think you can make a very compelling case the best Confederate division on this battlefield is John Bell Hood's division. And these are all experienced commanders. These are experienced troops.
Mm-hmm.
You have maybe one of the very best brigades, the Confederate Army and the Texas Brigade there. This is an elite unit under the command of someone you could argue maybe is Lee's best division commander on this battlefield.
I mean, they still manage to do a heck of a lot of damage and stay in there, even when they get all separated, they lose their control.
And I think this is where it's important that we establish these are experienced troops, mm-hmm. these are experienced exactly. commanders, because that's going to explain in large part how does a brigade fight for almost 2.5 hours this battlefield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't see that often here at Gettysburg. A lot of the actions we have discussed in this show are typically 20, 30, maybe 40 minutes of action. They're in this thing at almost every phase of the wheat field that we will talk about.
Yeah.
Anderson is there.
Yeah, he is. Now, Gettysburg, though, is really going to be his first major action in command of the brigade. When the war starts out, he is initially colonel of the 11th Georgia, which is one of the regiments that will follow him here to Gettysburg. He saw action during the Peninsula Campaign, commanded the brigade briefly during the Seven Days battles, was at Second Bull Run, Fox's Gap, Antietam, and Fredericksburg, but he seems to have seen little action at Sharpsburg. I guess they were mostly in reserve. So now one account in Malvern Hill had him personally trying to rally the 11th Georgia when the newly appointed colonel had disappeared. He goes, "Boys, stick to the colors," he yelled as he tried to push them into the face of the federal fire. But he was transferred to Hood's division at the end of October 1862. Now his brigade, now under Hood, apparently didn't see a lot of casualties at the Battle of Fredericksburg. They are then off with Longstreet on the Suffolk campaign during what is otherwise the Chancellorsville campaign. So they don't see a lot of action there. And so when they come into Gettysburg, again, Anderson commanding the brigade, but it's really going to be the first heavy fighting he's going to personally be involved in since give or take about the summer of 1862.
That's always, I think, an interesting dynamic on this battlefield. Commanders that have had success as regimental commanders have seen a lot of action as regimental commanders, but they do get that kind of brief stint in brigade command or sometimes in division mm-hmm. command. If we think back to our Culp's Hill episodes, we talked about George Greene. One of those sort of recurring things we see with Greene is that as others get wounded, Greene takes over higher mm-hmm. rank, which gives you at least a taste of it. So I think for someone like Anderson, he has had experience as a soldier before the war. He has seen plenty of action as a regimental commander. Mm-hmm. So I think making that leap to brigade command is not as difficult. I think he's had at least some sense of what it's like.
Yeah. You know, I think a couple thoughts come to mind there. One, yeah, you can make the leap. Probably what you might need a little bit of work with is maybe just getting to know some of the other regiments, mm-hmm. the officers, and obviously the level of command and control, even though I know some people don't use that phrase anymore, the level of command and control at a brigade level is obviously different mm-hmm. than when you're leading a regiment. But there's nothing in Anderson's background, or frankly, nothing in his performance at Gettysburg that suggests he can't handle it. He's just a good, hard-hitting, tough-fighting son of a bitch. I mean, really.
And that division's full of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it starts at the top. And so this is going to be, I think we really see the tenacity and in many ways, the wheat field in Georgia against the world there. I mean, outside of Kershaw, we're talking all about Georgians mm-hmm. here, mm-hmm. Multiple brigades of Georgians. So,
hey, don't forget those guys from Arkansas, too.
Well, that's, you know, they're part of the Texas Brigade.
They barely made the line.
Yeah,
they barely made it here.
I often say certain battles define a state. You know, you think about New Jersey at Chancellorsville. I would say North Carolina at Gettysburg. I would say on July 2nd, in many ways, July 2nd is Georgia's day on the battlefield. And I'm not discounting the men of George Doles or John Gordon. It's really remarkable the number of Georgia troops that you're going to see in that really confined space.
Yeah, and I'm sure the Georgia Chamber of Commerce will thank you for that when they hear this episode.
Well, and of course, many of the veterans, as we know, mm-hmm. were fans of Georgia Championship Wrestling.
It is 6:05 as we're starting
tonight. It is 6:05, the time that we should all go with our families and watch professional wrestling.
You know, the only other thing that I was going to add is, obviously, to many people, Gettysburg defines their mm-hmm. military career. And what I think a story like Anderson and so many other stories often reminds me when you come back and revisit it is because we memorize our Gettysburg order of battle. And then we're lucky if we can remember the order of battle from other engagements. But because we're so focused on the Gettysburg order of battle, you often forget, in some cases, many of these guys had not been in command of their particular mm-hmm. brigade or division or whatever we associate them with for very long. So in addition to the stress and everything that would normally go into this sort of combat, a lot of times you do have a guy who is maybe learning a new job on the fly.
So now that we've introduced Anderson, what would have been the regiments that would have been part of Anderson's brigade? So those kind of keeping track at home, who are the regiments under the command of George Anderson?
Okay, so Anderson's brigade at Gettysburg includes, we're going to include the 7th Georgia, even though they are really detached, kind of pushed off to the south to watch for cavalry and really don't see a lot of action.
But they are part of the brigade.
They are part of the brigade. The main units, though, that are going to go into action and suffer the casualties in and around the wheat field are the 8th Georgia, the 9th Georgia, the 11th Georgia, which we said is Anderson's old regiment, and the 59th Georgia. So if you add in the 7th Georgia, there's about 1,872 guys in the brigade, suffering about 720 casualties for a 38.6% casualty rate. But if you deduct that 7th Georgia, then the casualty rate jumps up to 47.3%, which obviously is pretty high for any brigade here at the Battle of Gettysburg. And, you know, this would be a great opportunity to give a shout out to our friend Richard Charles Allen from Baltimore, better known as Rick Allen to many of his friends and families. Rick did a great brigade roster of Anderson's brigade of all of the each volume is like its own regiment. And if you really want to deep dive on each one of the regiments, now Rick's books, Savis Beatty, they're hard to find, but I would certainly encourage you to go seek them out and to learn more about this exciting and colorful brigade.
I don't think Anderson's brigade would be a brigade that if we said, all right, who are hard-hit Confederate mm-hmm. brigades in the Battle of right. Gettysburg? I don't think Anderson would be necessarily, I mean, we're looking at losses comparable to Barksdale's brigade.
Mm-hmm, yeah, right.
To put that in perspective, Barksdale loses somewhere in the ballpark around 50%, and give or take.
How many men are we saying are actually involved that day?
How many are involved in the wheat field itself? The number you usually hear is about 20,000. Mm-hmm. My head count actually puts it at about 18,000. So, folks, we can quibble, but let's say around 18 to 20,000.
But we have a group of about 1,500 men who were there almost the entire time.
Yeah.
And that's impressive.
That's impressive.
That's 18 to 20,000 people on just a little over 200 acres. Yeah. That's a lot of people packed into a confined space. And one of the things I often point out when you go and do a tour of the wheat field, in many ways, the wheat field itself is almost like being in the bottom of a punch bowl.
Mm-hmm.
You have high ground really all around you on every side.
Yeah.
And what you see is you're throwing 18 to 20,000 people into a very confined space, and they're all shooting at each other.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons why you have such, I think, the casualties in that area, is that there isn't really the room to maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, the wheat field, dare I say, is almost like a steel cage. You're sort of trapped in that area that you're sort of, as you look at a lot of these attacks tactically, as we're going to talk about later, there's very little ability to maneuver. That means you're straight ahead. That means you're going right into the guns.
We've replaced the wheat field name with the Rose Farm, and now instead of the Whirlpool of Death, we're calling it the Cage Match.
Yeah. I mean, dare I say, a fine creation from the state of Georgia, the concept of a war games cage match. Yeah. I think that's how we would look. I think that's how the Georgians would have viewed it as.
And think about it then, as you sort of go to your main event here. In this corner, you have George Tighe, short for Tiger Anderson. And in the other corner, you bring in the French aristocrat, Philippe Regis de Trubriand. I'm not sure which one the crowd is going for on that one.
I would love
How do you think that's going to play in the Georgia territory?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm thinking de Trubriand might be the heel in the Georgia territory.
You know, I'm just picturing Anderson as guys like the Fabulous Freebirds right now. That's what I'm picturing, but I digress. So it is going to be a really confined space, and that's something that I think shocks a lot of people when you do a wheat field tour, is really, it's not a big space. A lot of the tours I do for the wheat field, Jody, you've been on a wheat field tour with me before, it's all walking. It's better, it's really, it lends itself well to walking on the field, and I think when you walk around, it doesn't take that long to cover that area. And imagining that many soldiers being thrown into it, it's almost hard to put it in perspective at times.
Well, the other thing too is the confusing cliche is the one that's always thrown around. It's really confusing because it's overlapping.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you want to be careful that people don't think it's 20,000 guys in there at one time, because of course it isn't. And this is where the phases come in. So the first phase, what we're calling the first phase, is going to be the placement of Sickles' troops in the wheat field itself, which we really haven't gotten to yet. And then they are going to be attacked by Anderson's guys. And then we'll see as we go back and forth here how it goes into these different phases. And they really overlap. Should we meet the Third Corps at this point?
Let's get the Third Corps onto the field. We've introduced the Confederates. Let's introduce the initial Union occupiers of the wheat field, so to speak.
Okay. You know, I'm kind of tired of talking about Dan Sickles. No, I'm really not.
Are you really?
No, I'm really not.
Don't lie.
But, you know, if it's been ground that's been covered before, no pun intended. But, of course, the morning of July 2nd, Sickles, as we know, according to Meade's instructions, extend the left of the Second Corps and occupy the range of hills that we know today as the Round Tops, if practicable to occupy it.
Wait, I only thought Lee used that word.
Exactly.
Wait, that's a term they just used back then?
That's a term.
I thought that was a Robert E. Lee invention.
And it's used even by the great George Gordon Meade.
Well, I'll be.
You know, and the funny thing
then
is...
it must be okay.
The funny thing is that word, that phrase comes from Meade's sworn testimony at the Joint Committee of the Conduct of the War. And I still encounter people on the battlefield who are like, no, Meade didn't say if practical. Well, I mean, it's in his sworn testimony. We digress.
Sworn testimony.
You know what? People should probably go to the What Was Sickles Thinking Super Bowl Halftime Spectacular
Extravaganza,
episode that we did a couple up years ago. So, all right, let's get to Trubriand's brigade. So when Sickles and the Third Corps came onto the field on the night of July 1st, 1863, into the morning of July 2nd, remember, de Trubriand's brigade, along with Burling, Smith's battery and Winslow's batteries were the ones that had been left behind at Emmitsburg. So Regis de Trobriand doesn't arrive on the battlefield until the morning of July 2nd. But when Sickles makes that move forward, that controversial, dastardly move that you all love to hate and hate to love, de Trobriand is part of Birney's division, will be pushed forward into the area today that we know as the wheat field. So if you think of Birney's division as sort of the left of this forward movement, we have Ward's brigade on the extreme left in Devil's Den. Next to Ward in the wheat field will be de Trobriand's brigade. And then further up beyond that will be Graham's, mostly Graham's brigade in and around the Peach Orchard area with Humphreys extending along the Emmitsburg Road. De Trobriand being in between Ward on the flank and Graham in the forward position, de Trobriand kind of being in the middle, didn't really think he was going to see action. And was initially, he says, he's kind of in columns, ready to support either side as contingencies might develop. But of course, he's going to have problems of his own when it gets started.
And I think that's an interesting point, that even though the wheat field is synonymous with such intense fighting, by 3-4 o'clock, it doesn't seem that's going to be where the heavy fighting is. It's probably going to be in Devil's Den. It's going to be up by the Peach Orchard. And initially, the wheat field, I don't want to say is unimportant, but it's kind of a secondary thought. As we'll see throughout these episodes, it's going to quickly turn into a focal point for George Meade.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just introduce everybody to de Trobriand a little bit, because we met Anderson.
He's another heavy hitter.
Again, kind of coming into the ring here, kind of with his French sort of airs about him, I suppose. De Trobriand has been described as a Renaissance man. Born in France to French aristocrats, emigrated to the United States in 1849. Now, de Trobriand was 47 years old at Gettysburg, so a little bit older, I think, than G.T. Anderson was. You know, he had been born in France, and I threw this in here for you, Eric. You tell me if this is right or wrong, but his father apparently had one time been a general serving in Napoleon Bonaparte's army. And, you know, if you've seen the new Napoleon movie, maybe this lamb chop was his destiny.
Ooh,
kind of thing. Yeah.
Ooh, there you go.
And if you haven't seen the movie, run out and see it, folks. And you'll know
not.
What I'm talking about.
Or not. Wait until the 4-hour extravaganza,
yeah,
folks.
Are there a lot of movies
around here that you should just wait on?
There are a few movies playing right now in the Christmas season.
Folks, if you think the ripping apart of the movie Gettysburg is bad, you should see what's going on in the Napoleonic world right now. Yeah. It makes Gettysburg nerds look tame. So,
now, de Trobriand did write poetry and prose, and he published a novel in 1840 while he was in Paris. Later on, he would continue to write, and I will say his memoirs, his Civil War memoirs, 4 years with the Army of the Potomac, are one of my favorites, and I've used them as references on many occasions when doing either my Third Corps work or work in the wheat field. So I do want to give a shout out to his book. He was an expert swordsman who fought a number of duels, so maybe that could have kind of been his ring thing, you know, as he was kind of coming in. But anyway, he emigrates to the United States in 1841. He eventually marries the daughter of a popular socialite. So now he's maybe, you know, marrying into some money and stuff like that. You know, they're going to move around a little bit. They're going to live in Venice, socialize with the nobility before eventually taking up permanent residence in New York, which is, I think, where they're going to be when the American Civil War starts in 1861. De Trobriand's going to become a naturalized citizen, and he will be commissioned as an officer and originally given command of the 55th New York Infantry. All right, so de Trobriand, you know, his unit takes part in, again, a lot of the early battles of the Eastern Theater, the Civil War. You know, we won't go into all of the great details on that, but he's going to get attached to the Third Corps at Fredericksburg. Initially, his regiment is going to be part of Ward's brigade of the Third Corps at Fredericksburg. And it's kind of at this point during this era of late 62 to early 63, he's going to start to come more into the military orbit of Daniel Edgar Sickles. And this, friends, is tonight's first installment of the Dan Sickles Report.
So the other one was just like a pre-installment.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a warm-up match.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Because, you know, you might wonder what he thought of sickles and serving under sickles. De Trobriand considered sickles, quote, in many ways a typical American. This is De Trobriand talking about sickles. He has a quick perception, an energetic will, prompt and supple intelligence, an active temperament. Sickles is naturally ambitious. He brings to the service of ambition a clear view, a practical judgment, and a deep knowledge of political tactics. When he is determined on anything, he prepares the way, assembles his forces, marches directly to the assault. Obstacles do not discourage him, but he never attempts the impossible. And he has, this is Sickles, has many strings to his bow. And if one breaks, he will replace it by another.
So that's very positive.
Very positive.
I often say our views of these individuals, sometimes the best way to look at them is, what did their contemporaries think of them? Mm-hmm. What did the people that served under them think? And one thing you will see is that, yes, there are people that do not like Dan Sickles and the Army of the Potomac, but there is, I think, more than would commonly be thought that do like Dan Sickles in the Army of the Potomac. And that has to be remembered not only before the Battle of Gettysburg, but also after the Battle of Gettysburg. So I know that when you read that quote, there are probably some people out there, you know, the steam's coming out of their ears, their faces getting all red because, oh my gosh, how dare you have a positive account of Dan Sickles? We're not giving the positive account. That was De Trobriand.
I'm simply reading the historical document, folks. Now, it's a lengthy account. I could go on and on and on and on, but I'll wrap up here. Eric, you mentioned sort of afterwards. There is something here that sort of plays to that. Quote, let a friend deceive him, or an enemy cease to oppose him, then both become equally indifferent to him, and he goes on his way, troubling himself no further about them. He rarely fails to make a good impression, even upon those who may be the least prepossessed in his favor. And I say that on tours a lot. We have a number of indications that Sickles would make a good impression on people, whether they be men or women. And, you know, when people look at Sickles' photo today, and sometimes I get this a lot on tours, like, oh, I don't understand how the ladies could love him. I think there's that aspect of the Sickles personality that, you know, gets lost looking at these grainy old photographs.
Well, and we also have the same photo of Sickles that kind of gets circulated. Yeah. He's got the baggy eyes and he's kind of, you know, if you look at Sickles, some of the earlier photos.
Like when he was
him,
in his political days.
Yeah, in his political days, or I would even argue early in the Army of the Potomac. He looks a lot different than some of the more photos that we often see of him.
I would argue the photo that I used, which was a National Archives photo on my book, Sickles at Gettysburg, is a much more dashing image of him.
Yes.
Because I know the one you're referring to that always gets passed around. So, folks, that's another reason why you should read Sickles at Gettysburg, because the cover image of Sickles, I think, much better captures the man than the baggy-eyed, kind of curly-haired version that you mentioned. Okay, we're going to go on here. So the other thing I want to point out, too, is De Trobriand also became very infused with the spirit of the Third Corps, and he became close to his division commander, General Birney, which I think does have some relevance to the wheat field here at Gettysburg. De Trobriand considered Birney, quote, a man of ability and education, a gentleman of excellent manners, as well as a distinguished officer. Birney had inherited the patriotism of his father, but not his father's political radicalism. And folks, I would throw Birney into that bucket of guys we talked about earlier who doesn't get talked about enough as an individual on the battlefield.
I think that's sort of the story of the Third Corps. Even though they're a relatively smaller corps, just two divisions, they're under the command of two very able soldiers, and Andrew Humphreys and David Birney. I would argue if there's someone that hates George Meade more than Dan Sickles, it might be David Birney.
Yeah.
But these are veteran brigades. These are veteran brigade commanders. And this Third Corps has seen a lot of fighting in the war up to this point. They're a very battle-tested corps coming into Gettysburg.
Yeah. Now, in the interest of time, I'll kind of take them up to Chancellorsville. At one point, his 55th New York had gotten merged with the 38th New York, and for a while he was colonel of that unit, where they fight at Chancellorsville, not heavily engaged, but then after the Third Corps was reorganized following the severe casualties of Chancellorsville, that was when De Trobriand was given command of the brigade. So he is commanding the brigade here at Gettysburg as a colonel. there does seem to be some indication in the writings that, you know, he might be feeling a little passed over, or maybe a little resentful because of this. He will comment in his memoirs that, you know, one of the great problems with the Army of the Potomac was that passed over officers, you know, was that the list for promotion did not come from military recommendations, but were often subject to outside influences. And you'll see some indication that between Chancellorsville and Gettysburg, Sickles is maybe kind of patting de Trobriand on the back a little bit and saying, don't worry, we're going to get you a star kind of thing. But at least he's leading this brigade here into Gettysburg as a colonel.
So who does de Trobriand have under his command, at least when he begins to enter the wheat field?
Eric, I'm glad you asked. So we're looking at the 17th Maine, the 3rd Michigan, and before we forget, so I'm going to do it now, every year I do two tours for the great folks at the Grand Rapids Christian Academy, where the 3rd Michigan was organized in the Grand Rapids. So I want to give a shout out once again to the Grand Rapids Christian Academy. Looking forward to seeing you guys on the field again. They're the 3rd Michigan, also the 5th Michigan, and the 110th Pennsylvania. Now, this is a comparatively small brigade. It's about 955 men. They are going to walk out of here suffering about 340 casualties for about a 36% casualty rate. But that really is de Trobriand's brigade. So Sickles has made the move forward. De Trobriand is in the wheat field. Initially, his regiments are going to be positioned kind of along this stone wall, right along the stone wall that kind of borders Rose's Woods out to the west. Probably most representative of this is the 17th Maine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's the 17th Maine. Well, and again, it's a great monument, folks. It's got a little guy behind a stone wall. Really, probably my favorite Maine monument on the battlefield, I think.
Ooh.
I didn't say it was my favorite unit, but okay. My favorite monument.
It's okay.
I mean, come on, the 20th Maine monument, there's nothing really to look at there, right?
Other than Buster Kilrain's name on it.
Exactly, right.
And honestly, if you drive by it, you'll miss it. You think of the stone wall as like a huge thing that they cowered behind, but it's really small.
Well, yeah, it's a good point. So the idea being 17th Maine now is pushed forward, and they are primarily firing into the left flank of the Confederates advancing on Devil's Den. And this gets back to our earlier conversation, where do we kind of draw that line? So during the Confederate attack on Devil's Den, you've got the 3rd Arkansas of Robertson's brigade, kind of pinned down at this point, fighting at Devil's Den. That's been a back and forth action, probably taking some fire from the 20th Indiana to their front. But you have now the 17th Maine kind of coming into the stone wall and firing into the left flank of the 3rd Arkansas. And that's really kind of the opening phases of the fighting in and around the wheat field itself, I think.
They're firing at troops advancing towards more or less Devil's Den. The fighting has not yet moved towards the wheat field. Keep that in mind. Anderson has not yet started moving towards the wheat field, so to speak. He's still advancing behind the Texas Brigade.
Exactly.
And it's soon going to be that firing from that direction that's going to draw Anderson's attention. And really, it's what's going to draw him into the wheat field.
Yep, exactly.
Did we address Anderson's approach at all?
No, because they kind of step off
right after
Robertson.
Right.
So this would actually probably be a good time to do that. Want to do that?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Let's do that. So remember, Hood's division has been moved to the Confederate right, looking for the enemy left. Yeah, I'm sorry, what was that word again?
Right.
There you go. They should have gone more to the right. But yeah, so they've moved to the Confederate right to try to drive in the Union left. Law's brigade has stepped off. Robertson's brigade has stepped off. Benning's brigade has stepped off. Again, they're getting pinned down at Little Round Top and Devil's Den and all that action going back and forth. One of the things that I think when you read particularly accounts from Hood's division is each brigade, as they step off and get engaged, starts complaining about lack of support, lack of any other Confederate brigade on their left. And Robertson's brigade is a great example of this. You know, as they're hunkered down around the foot of Hawks Ridge, they are looking towards their left. Where the hell is our support? Well, eventually Anderson's brigade will step off and move in and cover that gap. So Anderson's brigade report was filed, by Colonel William W. White of the 7th Georgia. Now, remember, in our introduction, we said the 7th Georgia really isn't part of this attack into the wheat field on July 2nd. But Anderson gets wounded during the action. White will be here. I think he probably gets here on the 3rd, and it will be White who files the report. So even though White did not witness what he's about to describe on July 2nd, he does say in his report, quote, "As I was not present myself, my regiment, the 7th, having been detached and ordered to the right and flank of the line to watch the movements of the enemy's cavalry, I have consolidated the reports of the regimental commanders." So even though he didn't see it, he's consolidated the reports of the guys who did. Here's what he says. Quote, "The scene of action was reached by a march of several miles under a broiling sun and a portion of the way a terrific fire of the enemy's batteries. The position of the brigade was on the extreme left of Hood's division, and when ordered to advance on the enemy's position, was to the rear and supporting the Texas Brigade." He then talks about the Texas Brigade became engaged. Anderson's guys moved forward when, quote, "a vigorous charge was made, which dislodged the enemy from a stone fence running diagonally with their line of battle." And I'm going to pause there because maybe that's where we want to stop and maybe now pick up more of the heavier fighting in part two.
Well, and it's interesting how he described that. That's a very quick, almost Cliff Notes version of what happened here. There's a lot more to the story than that. But this is another example of when we look at some of these primary source accounts, it's in the OR. It's an official report.
Yeah.
But keep in mind the perspective that the writer would have had. Also, there's going to be a lot of casualties among the officers in Anderson's brigade in the course of this fight. That's going to impact how we often view this. Mm-hmm. And so keep that in mind that the author of this report was not in this fight that he is describing.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, the official reports very often are sanitized version. I've got reports of some of the other subordinates here. And you're right. You know, you kind of piece it together to come up with what is considered an official version of what they did. But I think it's a good point to stop because I think we've kind of agreed. Part one, we were going to introduce the key players of what will be phase one. Now, there's a lot of key players we haven't met yet. Semmes, Kershaw, the 5th Corps, Tilton and Schweitzer. But this has at least gotten guys onto the field. Folks, you've gotten your Dan Sickles report and then some. We've met Detrabrand. We've met Anderson. Hopefully we have a better or kind of a ring fence, a steel cage, as you put it, around what the wheat field and the Rose Farm is going to be.
Renamed everything, so I think we're done here.
Yeah, we've completely, hopefully the National Park Service will oblige us with new signage and such. So please, folks, write your congressman. But I think this is a good point to kind of stop. Because now the fighting is about to shift to the quote-unquote wheat field itself. So that's, I think, a good point to pause. As Jim said, we've introduced the key players, at least up to what we will consider the first phase. And part two will then, of course, go into that first phase of fighting.
So as we said at the beginning, we know listeners were really excited about this. There might be some who are disappointed that they're going to have to wait for part two.
The anticipation.
Exactly.
It'll be great.
Isn't anticipation what life is all about, exactly. Superfan Jody?
And also, do we really want to do a 12-hour episode on the wheat field?
We want to do 12 one-hour episodes
on the
wheat
field. Exactly. Smart, not hard,
That's
folks.
Right. That's right. Should we put a bow on the wheat field? Should we go in and wrap a bow around the golden ripe wheat and put a bow on it?
I think for right now, this is a good point to stop. So we just want to remind everyone very quickly that if you check out the show notes of the episode, you will find ways to give reviews of the show. Also, ways that you can donate to the show as well. Also, don't forget our YouTube page. We have really been trying to promote that. For those that say, you know, you guys don't produce a lot of stuff, we are putting things out almost every month.
Yeah,
it's not just what you see in your podcast feed, folks.
That's right.
It's also what's on YouTube. It's what's being done elsewhere. So please, if you haven't given a chance, like our YouTube page. Give it a like. Give it a subscription. Check it out because there's a lot of
you a gift with the wheat field. You give us a gift.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're putting a lot of great material out there that is beyond just the episodes we've done as well.
We like to think it's great anyways, and it is great.
So with that, on behalf of everyone here, I want to thank you all for listening. This has been the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast.